This Friday is July 4th. So in our series on Proverbs that have shaped us, we're going to talk about one of the struggles I had with nationalism. Nationalism, especially being an American. And we need a proper context for this to realize that we're here to be part of the solution, not just to cut down everything and to criticize it. So I've asked the appointed sisters to come and set a tone for us. You'll be asked to join them in singing in a little while. But listen as these three put our hearts where they need to be when we consider nationalism, when we consider our country.
God bless America, land that I love. Stand beside her and guide her through the night with the light from above. From the mountains to the prairies to the oceans white with foam. God bless America, my home, sweet home.
This Friday is July 4th, which is the anniversary of our declaration to be free from Great Britain in 1776. As a church, we're going to celebrate this freedom, as Blake has shared, on Wednesday with a full meal and fun for the whole family, a great time celebrating our freedom as Americans and as Christians. And even though I'm looking forward to that time together, it touches a nerve in me that I've had since high school. You see, as a baby boomer, somebody born between 1946 and 64, my formative years were shaped by incidents such as all the Vietnam protests back in America, Watergate, that whole scandal, Richard Nixon's resignation as our president, and him, a Quaker at that. I became suspicious of what goes on behind the closed doors of our federal government. And that suspicion slowly eroded my loyalty to most human organizations, including to some degree the one housed in Washington, D.C. It's hard to be very patriotic when you have a negative slant on what's going on in the White House. I love America. I get misty-eyed when songs like the Appointed Sisters Just Sing are played, and I get to sing. I'm very appreciative of the freedoms that we have. Don't take them for granted. They're eroding under our feet as we speak. But when suspicion is thrown into the pot, nationalism becomes a bit of a struggle. Thankfully, the book of Proverbs has helped me address my struggle. And I'd like to explain how this morning. And I'd like us to begin with our primary passage, Proverbs 14:34. You can find your way there. Proverbs 14:34. Solomon wrote, under the inspiration of the Spirit of God, righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. Let me say it again. Righteousness exalts a nation, but disgrace, but reproach. But sin is a reproach to any people. The word righteousness always involves conformity to a standard. It always involves that, regardless of the context. The only question is, what's the standard in this passage? Well, since the context is about all people, it's about all nations, not just Israel, the standard referred to must be that which is hardwired into every human being at birth. It is known as our moral code or moral DNA that is an inherent part of being made in the image of God. Our Creator has placed this inherent code of right and wrong into every human being, and you can observe that moral code among all peoples in every culture throughout all of history. Let me give you two examples. It's always wrong to take innocent human life. Now, you may interpret what innocent means differently from culture to culture, but if it's an innocent human life, there's something wrong about taking it. God put that belief into every human being because we're made in His image. That's part of our moral code. Another one would be, it is wrong to take another person's property. Now, there may be circumstances in which that law is suspended, that principle is overrided by another law, such as in a time of war. But the truth is, across the board, in all cultures, in all times, among all peoples, it's wrong to take another person's property. These are reflections of this moral code. What this means, then, is that the standard of righteousness that is referred to in Proverbs 14:34 is the character of God Himself as it has been expressed in those made in His image. When a nation's citizens live on the basis of their inherent moral DNA, then that nation, according to this passage, will be exalted. The word exalt carries with it the idea of making something high, giving it prominence, making it a leader, putting it in a leadership role. See, what makes our country great, not its monetary or military might, but its morality, its sense of duty and responsibility to behave in accordance with the way we're hardwired by our Creator. And that applies to, according to this passage, every nation. Now, the word nation here is the Hebrew word goy. Kylan Dalich, two now deceased commentators, defined goy as, and I quote, a mass swollen up from a common origin, end quote. A mass swollen up from a common origin. With reference to Israel, this would go back in time to when God called Abram in 2100 BC to birth through him a nation after spending 400 years in Egypt, eventually under bondage. She fled from her mother, Egypt, now 2.5 to 3.5 million people strong. She was that swollen mass begun with that little seed called Abram. With reference to America, our origin goes back to July 4th, 1776, when our founding fathers issued the Declaration of Independence from Mother England. Viewed her as oppressive, and the common law of the English citizens around the world throughout the British Empire, it was innately understood. If you are not given any rights, if you're not given the privilege of voice, you have a right to rebel. And so we did. And so we became a swollen mass on July 4, 1776, as we came out of, eventually, the American Revolution. And from that humble origin, speaking as an American, where my struggle has been, we grew into the swollen mass we are today. Now I want you to notice the contrast in this verse. But sin is a reproach to any people. The word sin means to, as we all know, miss the mark, fall short. To fall short of, there it is again, of a standard. What's the standard here? Righteousness involves a standard, so does sin. Righteousness means to attain to the standard. Sin is to mean to fall short, to miss that standard. It is the direct opposite of righteousness, or it is a reference to God's falling short of God's character as expressed in our moral DNA. Contextually, it includes falling from our birthright, from our origin, for Israel, It refers to all those repeated violations against the Mosaic covenant. They turn their back on God, on Yahweh, their covenant keeper. And her call to be a light to the Gentiles. When she backed away from that, when she ran, when she rebelled, she sinned in this sense. She fell from that standard, the Mosaic covenant. The Mosaic covenant was a enhanced expression of that moral DNA. It took it in seed form and expanded it so it became hundreds and hundreds of stipulations to guide their lives as a redeemed people. When she rebelled from that, she sinned, according to Proverbs 14:34. For America, our sin refers to our abandonment from what set our course, our Declaration of Independence, our Constitution, our Bill of Rights. The more we fall from that, go astray from that, the more, according to this passage, we stray. Because all those documents were, in essence, an expression of the moral code our Creator hardwired into us. That sin, or that fall, bursts the last part of this passage: reproach, disgrace, shame. That's what you feel inside when you hang your head with your tail between your legs. Or should I say, it's what you should feel. And notice to whom this principle applies, this truth applies in Proverbs 14:34. People, all people. This is the Hebrew word yam. That refers to a people that did not arise from a common mass, become a swollen mass from a common origin. This refers to a people held together by a common law, a group of laws. For Israel, it's the Mosaic Covenant. That was her constitution. For us, it's the Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Constitution, the Bill of Rights. That's what holds us together. And here's the point. Bruce K. Walkie, former Hebrew professor of Regis and mine at Dallas Seminary, he had said it this way: ultimately, a nation's exaltation depends on its piety and ethics, not in its political, military, and or economic greatness. There's nothing wrong with economic, military, or political greatness. That's not what makes us great. That's not our basis of exaltation. It is our righteousness before our Creator. It is to live in accordance, for our citizens to live in accordance with a moral code He's placed within us, expressed in the documents that gave birth to us as a free people. Now let's probe a little deeper. Let's look at the results of righteousness in a little more detail. You see, the effects of righteousness are found both within the boundaries of that country, whatever nation it is, whether it's Israel or America or Canada, and outside those boundaries. We want to go back to our passage in Proverbs 14:34 and see what this whole sense of exaltation refers to. I'll call it global leadership. Global leadership. Righteousness exalts or provides global leadership for a nation, but sin is reproach to any people. Do you know in past times, for a long time, the rest of the world came to America to study our churches, our pulpits? They came to our schools. They came to our factories and farms to study how we're doing it, because we were world leaders in all those areas. And now, they still come, but only as a trickle, because we're not the world leaders we once were. Our righteousness is not exalting us and giving us that premier position across the globe. We once provided military assistance to countries abused by evil world power mongers, and we stepped in. We'll help you out. We don't have to take you over, but we'll help you get on your feet. That's one of the things that made us great. That's where we were leaders. How about whenever there was a global disaster, we provided humanitarian aid and assistance to those countries. We still do in part, but not quite with the same fervency that we once did. We led the world in our standard of living. The world came to us and said, how can you make that happen where people live like kings when we live like paupers? We became the standard of living and economic development. These are just a few of the ways in which we led the world. In fact, a great statue given as a gift from the country of France to us that lies in New York Harbor was once a symbol of our global leadership. But like the monument, our global leadership has diminished over the years. There's a second result of righteousness, and that's found in Proverbs 28, verse 12. It says this, "When the righteous rejoice, there is great glory." When the righteous rejoice, when we're leading the way, when our lifestyle is applauded in a country, whatever that country is, there's great glory in that nation, among that people. But when the wicked arise, we just duck. We hide ourselves. In His providence, God created America to serve as the leading player in the outworking of His plan in human history over the course of the world's emergence from, in essence, being a purely agrarian state to an industrial state to a technological state. He birthed us to serve as the leader, the pace setter, in that long and difficult process that has encompassed the globe, more or less. That also involves several world wars that could have demolished the earth, and there we were, including the Cold War with communism. Since that time, however, because of lack of righteousness in our citizens, operating out of that moral DNA, that moral code, our international splendor has dimmed as evil men have risen and led the way. It was January 25th, 1974 that Ronald Reagan said, "I've always had a great affection for the words of John Winthrop, delivered to a small band of pilgrims on the tiny ship Arabella off the coast of Massachusetts in 1630. This is what Ronald Reagan read as he quoted John Winthrop. "We shall be a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us. So that if we shall deal falsely with our God in this work we have undertaken, and so cause Him to withdraw His present help from us, we shall be made a story and a byword throughout the world." Well, Ronald Reagan went on to say, America has not been a story or a byword. That small community of pilgrims prospered, and driven by the dreams and, yes, by the ideas of the founding fathers, went on to become a beacon to all the oppressed and poor of the world. I'd like to say this, that glow, that international splendor, that city on the hill, has diminished its light over the past half century. Hadn't been long, and we're not what we once were. A third result of righteousness is found in Proverbs 28:28, which says, "When the wicked arise, men hide themselves, but when they perish, when the wicked go underground and are not leading the way, the righteous increase." In the case of our country, righteousness was once applauded, encouraged, so her numbers swelled, righteous people. It was more about character than anything else years ago. Over the years, it was simply accepted. Oh, okay, that's nice. You're a righteous guy. You're a good guy. You don't lie too much. That's fine. That's good. Eventually, it was just tolerated. Okay, if you have to. And now, it's almost despised. Penalized. It's not your character. It's what you can get done. How smart you are. How pretty you are. How strong you are, how you can maneuver, how you know the ropes. Why? Because we, our country, our citizens, have failed to live out of the moral DNA our Creator has placed within us. Let's look at two effects of unrighteousness in our country. They too are within our boundaries and outside our boundaries. The first one is in Proverbs 28:2. Political instability. Because of the transgression of a land, many are its princes. That's political instability. But by a man of understanding and knowledge, right will be prolonged. Is there a place for a real leader? Will he even be allowed to lead? In the land where transgression abounds, boy, its princes abound as well. It was William McCain who said, and I quote, "A land gets the kind of statesman it deserves. When violence begets violence, rulers come and go. This is a reflection of a deep-seated and widespread social indiscipline and disorder. Such a community as ours will not raise knowledgeable and perceptive statesmen. And no tradition of stable rule and judicious management affairs will be established within it." Are there exceptions to the rule? Of course there are. There almost always are. Not picking on any individual, but across the board, something has changed in our land. And there is political instability. For when we turn from our Creator and fail to operate according to the moral DNA, instability sets in. And the citizens from the grassroots and all the way up, so we get the kind of statesman we deserve as a people. And with it, all the political tug of wars, all to the detriment of long range wisdom and true social justice. We're not taking care of things. We're too busy talking about stuff. There's a second result of unrighteousness. And for that we go back to our Proverbs 14:34. Righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach. There's our word, a reproach to any people. Most of the Muslim world considers America to be the Satan. And you know what? I agree. If they study our television, they study our airwaves, they study our public arenas, they will conclude, at least in a figurative sense, we are the Satan. We reflect the values of evil. We have become more concerned about who is to blame than being responsible for ourselves. The problem is always you, it's not me. Become a people of that bent. The exceptions, of course there are. You may be the exception, but across the board, that's our paradigm. That has given rise to a litigious culture in which illegitimate lawsuits are as common as pollen in the spring air. There's a place for a legitimate lawsuit. But we're a country who's choking on them. As a nation, I think we seem more concerned about being liked than about being respected anymore. We seem very content in serving as a contestant in an international popularity contest about being respected around the world. What will they say? Many of our politicians seem more focused on their right now, right here, than on how our decisions will affect future generations of Americans. Look at the debt that I'm putting on my grandchildren, on their children, and then their grandchildren, and on and on and on. When we fail to consider the future citizens of America, we have committed national narcissism. Our pining spirit, once evidenced by the likes of Lewis and Clark, has given way to apathy and complacency in the way things are. Our work ethic, which still dominates much down in the South, isn't the same across the board. And not excusing the South. Our work ethic and our educational excellence has taken a real hit. We're in hard times as the world is leaving us in its dust. And I know many of you work diligently. You give your heart and soul and your body, and you're not getting rich in the process of serving as a school official, administrator, a teacher, a teacher's aide. I know you're working hard. You're doing it to honor God. But be honest, is it different teaching now than it was 10 or 15, 20 years ago? Don't we call it paperwork? It's hard just getting in the lives of people and developing their abilities to become responsible, independent citizens when you got a pile of paperwork staring you in the face. It's different. This is not pointing a finger at any individual. In this church, there are many exceptions to all these rules or statements. But across the board, this is what we are as a people. This is what we have become. We are obsessed in saying the right thing rather than doing the right thing. But of course, by saying the right thing, I mean the politically correct thing. Nationalism must be based on the fact that righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. Now, I'd like to move to a subject that touches on this one because of the mess we're in. What about all the promises that God made to the nation Israel? How do they apply to us as Americans? What can we claim as promises that God makes to us? And I'd like to begin with perhaps the most frequently used one in our land now. 2 Chronicles 7:13-14. And I'm sorry I'm stepping on some toes in here. You can challenge me later if you think I'm wrong when we're done assessing the use of such promises. I believe that God's promises to Israel must be very carefully interpreted, understood, and then very sensitively applied to us as Americans or any other nation. Here's the passage. When I shut up heaven and there is no rain, or command the locust to devour the land, or send pestilence among my people, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and heal their land. Do you see the ones to whom this is addressed? My people who are called by my name. My people is found 17 times in 1 Chronicles 6 through chapter 7, verse 10. My people is clearly a reference to the descendants of the 12 tribes of Israel. Contextually, just using this text, that does not refer to America or any other nation except Israel. The second part of that is they're called by my name. What had just happened in this part of Chronicles? Solomon had built Israel a temple in Jerusalem, the love of his daddy's life, and it just dedicated to him. So the people who are called by name are those who are personally identified with Yahweh, the Lord, through the Mosaic covenant, who would begin meeting with him at the temple in Jerusalem after Solomon had just erected it and now had dedicated it. This promise is to the nation Israel. I want you to look in verse 13 at the three conditions that the people of Israel would experience. The absence of rain, locusts, and pestilence. Those three conditions are specifically referred to in the cursing section of the Mosaic Covenant. Here's the Mosaic Covenant, first given in 1445 BC, Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb, to Moses and the Israelites after their exodus en route to the land flowing with milk and honey. If you obey me, I will bless you. Here's how I'm going to bless you. If you disobey me, here's how I'm going to curse you to draw you back to myself. Basically, that which is found in Deuteronomy 28. Let's look at how these relate to the passage in Deuteronomy 28. First of all, the lack of rain. Deuteronomy 28, 23, and 24 says, "And your heavens which are over your head shall be bronze." No, I'm not describing North Central Texas. "And the earth which is under you shall be iron." You ever try to use a post hole digger in this turf? Woo! "The Lord will change the rain of your land to powder and dust. From the heaven it shall come down on you until you are destroyed." You disobey the Mosaic Covenant, all 613 of its directives and stipulations, you can expect no rain on your crops. Pretty tough in an agrarian culture. How about locusts? Deuteronomy 28:42 promised this curse for disobedience to the law. "Locusts shall consume all your trees and the produce of your land." Just harvest a nice crop, huh? Don't blink. Locusts can come and scarf it down in a night. How about the pestilence? Deuteronomy 28, 21, and 22 says, "The Lord will make the plague cling to you until he has consumed you from the land which you're going to possess. The Lord will strike you with consumption, with fever, with inflammation, with severe burning fever, with a sword, with scorching, with mildew. They shall pursue you until you perish." Pestilence will consume the land of Israel if you walk away from your constitution, from your covenant that I have made with you. I will curse you so you'll turn back to me when you're really hurting, so I can forgive you and restore your land. So here it is. When I shut up heaven and there's no rain, or I command the locusts to devour the land or send pestilence among my people, clearly, biblically, references to Israel's disobedience to the Mosaic Covenant says this: "If my people who are called by name, if the descendants of Jacob, of the 12 tribes of Israel, will humble themselves and pray and seek my face, turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven, will forgive their sin, their violations of the Mosaic Covenant, and I will heal their land. There'll be plenty of rain, no locusts, and no pestilence whatsoever." So, God made the promise in 2 Chronicles 7, 13 and 14 to Israel, not America. Because the people of Israel were his covenant people, and the negative consequences of what they experienced were specifically due to their violation of the Mosaic Covenant. You know the story of Elijah up on Mount Carmel where he prayed that it wouldn't rain for 3.5 years? Why? They had violated the Mosaic Covenant. Once they repented, he prayed and it rained again, and it drenched the land. How about the book of Joel, the prophet Joel? The locust devouring the land, and on and on and on. His promise to restore his blessings on them was conditioned upon a national return to him and a commitment to obey that covenant. As American Christians, we can and should pray to our Creator, the God of this land, for rain, for his renewed involvement in our lives. But we can't claim this promise because he made it to Israel, not us, and we're eavesdropping. They're principles, but not the promise. We need to be careful. Other promises to Israel must be interpreted and applied in the same manner. Let me give you another one just for a moment. You can turn there if you want. I'll put up one of the verses I really want to zero in a moment. It's Psalm 91, 1 through 10. Many of you have read it and love it. It's one I go to frequently. Psalm 91, 1 through 10 says this: "He who dwells in the secret place of the Most High, El Elyon, shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty, El Shaddai. I will say of the Lord, He's my refuge and my fortress, my God, in whom I trust. Verse 5, you shall not be afraid of the terror by night, nor of the arrow that flies by day, nor of the pestilence. That's the same word used in Deuteronomy 28. Or of the pestilence that walks in darkness, nor of the destruction that lays waste at noontime. Here's a passage I'd like you to zero in on. Verse 7. 1,000 may fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand. On your left hand, you may have 1,000 fellow soldiers die. 10,000 may die that are on your right side, but it shall not come near you. Only with your eyes shall you look and see the reward of the wicked. Why? Because you, that Israelite infantryman, if you will, because you have made the Lord, who is my refuge, even the Most High, your dwelling place. No evil shall befall you, nor shall any plague come near your dwelling. You are in obedience to the Mosaic covenant, and God would provide supranormal protection in spite of everything that's happening around you for that person. I know of several people personally and in this church who claimed this promise because they were eavesdropping on God speaking to Israel in Psalm 91. Are there principles? Tons of them. But not the promise of supernatural protection in war. And these dear folks would claim this promise for their family members. I know mothers and wives that sent their husbands and sons across the big pond to the east of us, over to the European front, or in the Pacific Rim, and lost them in war, whose bodies are buried somewhere over there or at sea. And they shook their fist at God and said, "You lied to me, because I claimed that promise for them, and you didn't come through." And yet what God says is, "I didn't make that promise to you. I made that to Israel, living in obedience under the Mosaic covenant." There are principles there. The principle is, nothing we experience will have not first passed through the fingers of God, and He has determined that it's ultimately for our good. But in the case of Stephen, that cost him his life. And yet, ultimately, that was his good. But that's not the promise he's making here. Let's not water down this promise. Let's let it speak. Speak to Israel, for whom it was intended. We need to be careful when we interpret promises God made to Israel before we apply them to us as Americans. Now let's land this plane in my struggle with nationalism and how we approach it. Trying to claim promises out of the Bible that are not ours to claim, or trying to point the finger at everybody out there at what they've done wrong in America. Criticize our president and our elected officials and so forth. So, how has the book of Proverbs helped me address my suspicion of government, especially our federal government? It's helped me to put it in perspective. Like any human organization, it is flawed. Every human organization is. Your marriage is. Your perfect marriage partner is. You are. Your significant other is. Everything is. Our jobs, our workplaces, every business, every industry is flawed. Even in our heyday, we did not bring heaven on earth in the height of American stature and leadership. There will always be something we can legitimately criticize about our government and nation until Jesus Christ ushers in His kingdom on earth. But what I discovered in working my way through Proverbs, none of that's the issue. You see, the issue, the question is not kind of what kind of nation I live in, but what kind of citizen I am in that nation. That's the question. For when I do point that finger at the White House, three of my fingers are pointing back at me. Tom, let me ask you this question. What are you bringing to the table? Are you adding to the corporate righteousness of the citizenry of America? Are you adding to the sin that continues to lead to our erosion and downfall? Really comes back to me. That's what I saw with Proverbs. Yeah, there are plenty of things to criticize. And as free people, we get to do that. That's okay. Not taking that right away from anybody. But ultimately, that's not where we need to land our plane. We need to land it right here in the human heart. What kind of a citizen am I? What kind of person am I? How do I fill out my 1040 in all of its many forms before I send them in? How about the laws of the land? Consider this. Am I obeying Romans 13, 1 through 7, which says, let every soul be subject to the governing authorities. That's the Apostle Paul. Who are the governing authorities? The Roman Empire, Caesar. We're in kindergarten compared to what he was operating under. And he said, be subject to the governing authorities. For there's no authority except from God. And the authorities that exist are appointed by God. He said, render therefore to all their due. Taxes to whom taxes. Custom to whom customs. Fear to whom fear. Honor to whom honor. We can criticize, but in our public arena, we support, we pray, we honor, we fear. My following through in my responsibility is found in 1 Timothy 2, 1 and 2, which says, therefore I exhort first of all that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men. For kings and for all who are in authority. You're praying for our president, Barack Obama, his VP? How about his cabinet? How about his wife and his two daughters for their protection? You'd pray for them. For God to give them wisdom. Maybe experience some hard knocks to do the things they ought to do and operate out of the moral code that God put in them. How about for Ted Cruz, his team, John Cornyn and his? How about Mac Thornberry, his crew as our congressman, his responsibilities? How about our Supreme Court, federal Supreme Court? How about Rick Perry, those men here in our community that represent us down in Austin? How about Glenn Barham and two of our brothers in this church that represent us on the city council? All the different school districts, the boards of those districts. We need to be people who are praying and supporting. Easy to criticize? You bet. Piece of cake. There's always fresh fodder for that. But it comes back to me. What am I doing to make a difference? How am I supporting and contributing to the corporate righteousness, conformity to the moral code of this nation? On Wednesday this week, we're going to celebrate our birth as a free people. And so I've asked the appointed sisters to come back up and remind us how God has blessed us as a country, as a nation, as a free people, so that we'll know how to pray for His touch on us.
Oh, beautiful for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain, for purple mountains' majesties above the fruited plain. America, America, God shed His grace on thee and crowned thy good with brotherhood from sea to shining sea. Oh, beautiful for pilgrim feet whose stern impassioned stress, a thoroughfare for freedom beat across the wilderness. America, America, God mend thine every flaw, confirm thy soul in control thy liberty in law. O beautiful for patriot dream that sees beyond the years, thine alabaster cities gleamed undimmed by human tears. America, America, God shed his grace on thee and crown thy good with brotherhood from sea to shining sea.
Righteousness exalts a nation, whether it be Israel or America, but sin, our corporate sin, is a disgrace. It is a reproach to any people. I'm part of that people, part of that nation. So are you. The question is not so much wrong with America as what am I contributing to its demise? Or better yet, what can I do? How can I live my life in such a way that the God I serve and the country I love can both be served at the same time by righteous, godly living, by blessing those around me, by contributing to the common righteousness of our great nation, whose eminence has dimmed, leadership diminished. God poured out his grace on us. He still can. That's why we're applying Proverbs 14:34 to ourselves. We're praying for his touch. And I want to do so by praying the prayer once prayed by our first president, George Washington, in his prayer for the United States of America. Let's pray that as we close. Almighty God, we make our earnest request that thou will keep the United States in thy holy protection. Thou wilt incline the hearts of the citizens to cultivate a spirit of subordination and obedience to government, and entertain a brotherly affection and love for one another and for their fellow citizens of the United States of America at large. And finally, that thou will most graciously be pleased to dispose us all to do justice, to love mercy, to demean ourselves with that charity, humility, pacific temper of mind, which were the characteristics of the divine author of our blessed religion, and without whose example in these things we can never hope to be a happy nation. Grant our supplication, we beseech thee, through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.